Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in the year 2000, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actor. If you've been to the cinema at all regularly over the past 30 years, you've almost certainly seen him in something. The psychopath in The Dirty Dozen, perhaps, or the sensitive detective in Clute, or most famously as Hawkeye Pierce in MASH. His performances are always strong, clever and interesting. An actor, he says, is there to be moulded. Born in Canada, he started his career in England, but moved to Hollywood in his early 30s. Now he's back in the West End, where he first appeared on stage in 1958, in a new play called Enigmatic Variations. The man who suffers from stage fright has come back to where it all began, because acting for him is something he has to do to live. It is my life, he says. He is Donald Sutherland. You've gone as far as to say, Mr. Sutherland, that you would never stop acting, even if somebody paid you $1 million. But why is it so necessary to
you? Well, maybe for $1 million.
But what is it? It's obviously in your blood.
Yes, I know. I don't know what it is. You let it go for a little bit, and then it comes raging back and compels me to go do it again.
Even though every time you go do it, you can be terribly sick, can't you? You get stage fright.
Dreadful, just dreadful. Even making movies, people say, well, you don't get sick making. I said, yeah, that's why when I have it now in my contract. Gary Cooper had a contract where he didn't have to speak for the first 7 days. Ingmar Bergman used to shoot for the first week and throw that film out and then start the shooting again. My contract says that I don't have to do the beginning 5 or 6 minutes of my character's appearance in the film for the first 2 or 3 weeks of shooting, so that the director and I get used to each other, so that the cameraman gets used to my face, so that we look at rushes and we make mistakes, and those mistakes appear in the middle of the film. And the audience takes their impression of the character in those first 5 or 10 minutes, the character they have, and everything else is an aberration, something bad that's happened to them.
You mentioned the director, and you've worked with some of the best, so many over the years, Fellini, Bertolucci, Louis Malle, Robert Altman, Robert Redford, indeed. It seems to me, reading everything you've said about them, that relationship with the director is also what compels you about this acting business, isn't it? You've talked about it almost as if it's an affair itself. It's a very intimate relationship.
It's excruciatingly intimate. It's so intimate that when the movie's finished and there's a kind of void, a lack of conversation, that sense of desperation and inadequacy that happens when you end a love affair. And your job is to find the truth, to find as much of the truth as you can, and to give that information to him. And he can take that and cut it together any way he wants and make his film out of it.
But therefore, you're doing absolutely what he wants. You're allowing yourself to be manipulated by him. You become his thing, as it were. Why don't your opinions count?
Oh, but it's my information that I'm giving him. that information is governed and processed through my opinions, and so they do count. And it's a vital relationship. It's vigorous.
One of the great directors you worked with, Nicholas Roeg, of course, who did Don't Look Now, told you that your opinion didn't count and you should mind your own business and do what he said.
Well, he did, and that taught me a huge lesson. You know, I told him I thought the ending should be like this, and he said, hang on a second, do you want to do the film? And I said, yes, of course I want to do the film. He said, then do the film. And I understood that directors make film, but they do. It's their vision that you have to satisfy.
I see entirely why they call you a director's actor. But anyway, you're going to this desert island, no director, no wife, no nobody, just you, alone with your music. What music are you going to play? What's the first one?
Peggy Lee. And there's a song that she sings that Frank Sinatra sang too, called The Best Is Yet to Come. I can only ever think of it in terms of the first line, which is, out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. the best is yet to come.
Peggy Lee singing The Best Is Yet to Come. Great song.
That's what it's like to work with Fellini. Fellini used to sit on my knee and direct when he was making that film. He made a film called Fellini's Casanova.
Fellini made you Casanova, but it was, of course, Nicholas Roeg, we were talking about earlier in Don't Look Now, who made you, or confirmed you, as it were, as an international sex symbol with Don't Look Now. So you've got a lot to thank him for.
Nick, you know, that's funny, that scene. They talk about it a lot in this. They don't talk about it at all in America, but in...
Why not?
I don't know why not.
It was so memorable.
But it was memorable because it reminded you of making love yourself. And it gave you time to reflect. You weren't voyeuristic. It was very, very beautifully done.
It was beautiful. And it was, I think, the first explicit sex scene in a mainstream film. That's why, for us, it was so memorable. But, of course, just for the record, people said that it was so beautiful and so moving that it had to be you were doing it for real. You weren't, were you?
Oh, God, I got to tell you something. No way. It wasn't about that. It was to describe to you what it was really like in that room. You know, you've got two unblimped Aeroflex cameras, which are making a dreadful noise. You've got everybody outside with earphones on. And Nick and Tony were there with the cameras, and Julie and I were there naked. And I had in my contract that there would be no frontal nudity. You couldn't see my sexual organ, because that's mine. It wasn't the character's, and I didn't want to have people kind of saying, oh, look, there's Donald's. And so we followed Nick's directions, and they were very short increments of time. He would say, you know, Donald, kiss Julie's shoulder, move your head slowly down to her elbow. Julie, move your head back, arc your neck back. I mean, there was all the time it was this grinding noise of these cameras. Tony Richmond laughing.
It did, as I say, make you, you know, into this film star that women fell for, found incredibly attractive. How was that for a man who, as I understand it, had actually been rather embarrassed about his appearance for so many years, certainly as a child, was called Goofy or Dumbo because he had big ears, you know. All of a sudden, he's kind of fancied the world over.
Oh, I wish somebody told me that then.
You mean you didn't know?
No. Wow. No, I still had the big ears, I'm afraid. What a wonderful idea. No, I'm afraid nobody told me then. That's a wonderful
thing. But people had told you, hadn't they? People had, first of all, they'd called you those nicknames early on, and people had told you that you looked odd, that you looked weird. You'd been turned down for some part because you looked weird, hadn't you?
Yeah, the first film I ever was offered, well, not offered, I went up for. I did an audition for a film called 3 in the Morning, and I did what I thought was a pretty good audition. And they phoned me the next morning, the director, the writer, and the producer, all three of them on a telephone, to tell me that I had given them a wonderful audition, and then that I had defined the character for the writer in a way that he was going to change some things that was so evocative, so clear, so precise. They were thrilled. And they were phoning me to explain to me, they said, why they weren't giving me the role. I was stunned. I sat down and I listened to them as they said, we've always felt that this was a kind of guy next door sort of character. And we talked together and we don't feel like you look like you've ever lived next door to anybody. And I had to live with this. I turned to my wife and said, I didn't get the job. What could I, you know?
But it, as we say, knocked you for six for quite some time, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did.
Tell me about your second record.
No, that's about sex. That's about making love. It's Mozart, but it's really Dennis Brain. He died in a car accident here in England. But in any event, it's a piece of music that just is so sexually luxurious for me. Anyway, it's Mozart's Horn Concerto. Thank you.
Dennis Brain playing the opening of Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 1 in D major, K412, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. One of the fascinating things for me, Donald Sutherland, about your career is that it all began here in the UK, that you appeared in the 50s on television here in things like The Saint and The Avengers. Yeah. I mean, you're kind of homegrown for us.
In The Saint, yeah. No, I started in Canada, in the University of Toronto, and I did some repertory theatre there in the summer. And I came to go to school here in London, and then left the school after a year and a half.
You had a bad time there, didn't you? Lambda.
Yeah, I had a difficult time with one teacher particularly, who's dead now, who felt that my voice didn't work for theatre. She tried to raise my voice an octave, and I couldn't speak for 3 months after that. So I left the school, and I was given a job at the Perth Repertory Theatre, and I went to work for David Stewart and Marjorie Dent.
And you did these bits of television and so on.
I didn't do them until 62, but I'd worked in the theatre for a good 2 or 3 years before I finally got a job on television.
But tell me who you were. Why did this son of a Canadian schoolteacher and a salesman decide? There wasn't any theatre in your background. Why did you decide to come here and to go into the theatre? You know, I've read that you said I was in a play before I even saw one. So it wasn't as if you were, you know, it was in the family or you were destined for the theatre. How did you know?
I knew that I wanted to be a sculptor. I drew a lot, and I had dreams of sculpting. And I went into the local candy shop to buy a jawbreaker or whatever the devil it was I bought. And there was a charcoal drawing at the end. Someone had done a drawing of Winston Churchill, which I thought was dreadful. And everybody was saying how wonderful it was. What a terrific piece of work. And I realized, I went home. It was in my head. It echoed in my head. I knew that what I wanted to do wouldn't receive the same kind of appreciation from people that piece of work had received. And in my 11-year-old head, even though I'd hardly seen a movie, and certainly there was no television, I somehow, in the course of a year, transferred all of that desire to be a sculptor to a desire to be an actor. And it probably came as much from reading war stories to kids whose fathers were in prison camps in Japan. And
So you liked the element of performance even then?
Yeah.
Although, again, by your own account, you were kind of a loner, weren't you? You were...
I was sick all the time. I spent a year in bed with rheumatic fever. I had polio. I had pneumonia. So I was alone a lot.
But you always had the deep, round voice.
Yeah, that one.
You were a DJ, too.
Yeah, well, I know that was just a fluke. I ended up being in a radio station because I came in to apologize for something stupid that I'd done, and they just lost a radio announcer, and they said, "Will you read this?" So I read this piece of copy on flimsy yellow paper, and they said, "Would you like to have a part-time job after school?" And I said, "Sure."
Record number 3.
That's Patsy Cline, Sweet Dreams. It's where I come from. It's Nova Scotia. She's our hero.
The whole night through, instead of having sweet dreams about you.
Patsy Cline and Sweet Dreams. Undoubtedly, Donald Sutherland, the turning point in your career was when you got to speak in The Dirty Dozen and got yourself noticed. Was that a piece of pure luck?
I was one of 6 people who were given a role, a non-speaking role in The Dirty Dozen. It was a terrific job. I was earning $600 a week, and it was wonderful for me.
So you were one of the 6 who didn't speak.
We were hired because we were Canadians in the event that we had to speak or we had to say something, yes sir, whatever. We said it with a North American accent. So we were there, and we were sitting at this green baize table, great big table that Bob Aldridge, the director, had put together with Telly Savalas and Lee Marvin and John Cassavetes and Clint Walker, who was a a star at that time. And he was playing a character named Posey, and they were having readings. And then they came to this scene where Clint Walker's character, Posey, had to pretend to be a general. And Clint interrupted and said, "Mr. Aldrich, I don't think it's appropriate for me as a representative of North American Indian people to play this silly section." And Aldrich didn't even look up. He just was pointed his finger at me and said, "You with the big ears, you do it." So the big ears came in handy because those handles got me noticed. And once again, I just did what he said. And in the end, it stayed in the picture. And Bob Aldrich's agent, he phoned me and said, "Bob asked me to phone you. He said, this is a real good scene for you, and you have a chance of getting noticed. You have a chance to get some work in the United States if you come over." I said, "Well, I don't have any money." So he said, "Well, then maybe you should stay there." I thought, heck, I'm not going to stay here. And I ended up phoning Christopher Plummer, who was an extraordinary Canadian actor. And I phoned Chris and asked him if I could borrow some money from him. He was in Stratford in Canada. And he said, "Go down to my lawyer. There'll be $1,500 for you tomorrow morning." And that was a fortune, you know. It was a fortune. It, sure. It was extraordinary. And Ingo Preminger's, who was the brother of Otto Preminger, he had a picture that he, because of that scene, that he wanted me to do. And he was the producer of MASH.
That was MASH.
Yeah.
That was what did it. Next piece of music.
Next piece of music is Chris, you know, Chris Plummer. And Chris is a wonderful jazz pianist. And whenever I hear Glenn Gould, I think of Chris, and I think of Canada, and so it's the Goldberg Variations of Glenn Gould, and it's Toronto, it's Cold Wind, it's everything. First CD, the compact disc that I ever bought in my life was that compact disc. And we were living in Paris. We've always lived there because Francine is French-Canadian, and she wanted the kids to have French roots. And I was in the little apartment that we had at the very beginning. And Rogue, my son, who's named after Nick Rogue, he was taking piano lessons, and we had a little piano in the apartment. And I was playing this CD, but it was loud. You could hear it clearly through the apartment, and she had been out shopping, and she came in the door, and she heard it, and she said, "Rogue?"
Wonderful.
Kiss her
quite.
A thousand
not
times.
It was Glenn Gould, and he was playing there, Bach's Goldberg Variation, number 13, actually, for two pianos, and that was recorded in 1955. I'm told, Donald, that you're a bit of a gambler, that you once won a Ferrari, is that right?
No, I won the money to buy a Ferrari. That was in Kelly's Heroes. Dirty Dozen had a wonderful poker school, too. Anyway, so I was in Kelly's Heroes making that picture, and Saturday night for 18, 24 hours, we had this poker session. I probably took out of it maybe $2,500, whatever it was. I don't remember, but I just remember the money that I had was all in Italian lira, and it was in a brown paper bag full of Italian lira. And I went into, on my day off, I went into Bologna, and there was a shop with a secondhand Ferrari in the window. And I went in, and there were three guys sitting there, and I asked them in Italian how much was the car in the window. And they didn't even pay any attention to me. And I showed them this bag of money, and I drove the car back to Umag.
So you like technology. You're a bit of a gambler. You've been very ill, as you say, on and off through your life, but you're also, are you a bit of a hypochondriac?
I don't think I'm a hypochondriac. Why would you say that?
I don't know. I read somewhere that you always feared being ill or always thought you were ill, but maybe you just have been ill.
I've been ill a lot, but I'm less of a hypochondriac. I'm aware of symptoms, and but I've recovered from a bunch of disastrous diseases.
Absolutely. I mean, spinal meningitis, I think, was the worst one. But you've had all these other things. But you're also a bit accident-prone, aren't you?
Well, I'm clumsy. Yeah. Jane Fonda, we lived together for a couple of years. And after we separated, she would, when someone said, you know, they'd seen me, she would say, what accident has he had? What's happened to him? She said I was pretty fragmented.
But it was a good relationship, that one. Went on
with Jane?
Time,
yeah. Oh, it was wonderful. It was lovely.
Record number 5.
It's the ballad of John and Yoko. I love the sound of it. I love everything that he says in it. And I've been here in this bed, in that place. And it just makes me laugh.
Made a light trip to Vienna. Eating chocolate cake in the bag.
The Beatles and the Ballad of John and Yoko. So, Donald Sutherland, 104 films or more.
What terrible grabber, though. I mean, to hear John say, glad to have the both of you back. There's no such thing as the both of you.
It's a
the
very
two
English
of you.
Thing. It's a very English thing, that. The both.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Is
yeah,
it
yeah.
the both of you? I hate it.
Yeah.
But you,
sure.
I interrupted you. You were talking about.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about your films. 104 of them. You've called it a horizontal career. What do you mean by horizontal?
I mean like a big plate of fruit and vegetables and sweetmeats and chocolate and stuff. I was with Goldie Hawn and Ellen Burstyn in Cannes 20 years ago, and they were talking about their films. They were talking about 6 or 7 films, and I had already made 40 or something. And they were building them vertically. And I realized that my impulse to work was not nearly so arbitrary as that. It was, and it looked like one of those wonderfully carved wooden platters with a wonderful shiny apple and a pomegranate, whatever, everything.
But full of variation.
Full of variation. You could take whatever you liked. You'd find this one you'd like and this one you wouldn't like. But
I wonder if their arbitrary was arbitrary. Weren't they actually calculating their way vertically to the top, which might be to the Oscar, as it were, if that's perceived as the top.
Maybe, I suppose. I don't know. That certainly was not my business. That was not what I was in.
That's what people... I mean, you are...
I was much more hedonistic.
It is very surprising that you have not got an Oscar, or indeed an Oscar nomination, and I think a lot of people feel it's very surprising. You know, you are kind of notably not there. Why not? The theory that's put forward is that you have done this horizontal thing, that you haven't calculated and made yourself kind of... given yourself commercial consistency and that you've damaged yourself, therefore.
Well, my theory is always that there were 5 other performances in it a year that I might have been offered a nomination that were better than mine, I think is more accurate.
Well, all the theories are flattering, because the other one is, of course, that you're just too generous and too selfless when you work. And I suppose the biggest example
that's
of that
absolutely
is...
true.
Of course it is. And I think Jane Fonda would agree, because, of course, she got the Oscar in Clute, but not least, again, because you were... such a marvellous support. You let her shine, didn't you? Or perhaps you were a bit in love with her even then.
Oh, we were so in love. We were living together then. We had a wonderful time.
Next record.
Oh, there's Dave Brubeck. Dave Brubeck and Take 5. When I was working here, just after I left Perth, I danced. I loved to dance. And Dave Brubeck is hard to dance to because it's 5 time, but... I remember walking in my shoes and carrying these special sneakers. And when I get in there, I put on the sneakers, and then I go up and I take this record of Dave Brubeck's Take 5.
Dave Brubeck and Take Five. So back on the stage, Donald Sutherland, first time in 19 years that you've trodden the boards. Surely there's something much more powerful about it, about being in contact with that audience than there is about making films, of feeling them, of being inspired by them.
Oh, no. No, no, no. There's nothing like the look of a director who's standing beside the camera, creating his film. Oh, gosh, there's nothing like it.
But it's almost as if you like the process of the acting, but you don't want to have too much to do with the result. That's somebody else's responsibility. That's his.
No, that's just a reality.
But you don't even go to see some of your films, do you?
Well, because I give this guy 1,000 pieces of information, and then he puts a character together of 750, and it's different from the character that's sitting inside me. And I go into the movie theater myself. I could take anything, but the character inside me, who's made up of 1,000 pieces, goes nuts.
But why don't you?
Drags me out of the cinema.
Why don't you want to see what he's done with it?
But I can a little later. But the character that was in me has to die first. I'm okay now. I'm fine. Kiefer told me when...
Your son, Kiefer.
Yeah, Six Degrees of Separation. Yeah, the other Kiefer is dead, bless him. 6 Degrees of Separation. He said, you should go see this. And he was right. And I could see it. And Fred Skepsy had done a job that really echoed what I had felt
but,
about
but
the character.
But I return to my point that when you're on the stage, frankly, whatever the director has taken you through beforehand, it's yours. You know, you've got the audience in the palm of your hand. You can do it.
Yeah, don't tell the director that. I know that.
But surely that's much more satisfying.
Well, not really, no. It's very satisfying. And it's lovely. I get a thrill each night at the Savoy when... And the audience has been so exquisitely responsive and...
But there you are. You make my point that you're getting deeper and deeper. It becomes more and more yours and only yours.
That's true.
I rest my case.
Your case is okay.
Record number 7, isn't it?
This song, one, I know the words so I can sing along. And two, I loved so much of what Janis was. Anyway, it's called Me and Bobby McGee. La na 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 na, la 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 la, baby.
Janis Joplin singing Me and Bobby McGee. Can you imagine yourself as a kind of Robinson Crusoe then, Donald? Are you practical, organizational?
Very, very practical.
Self-reliant?
I would be very practical.
And you're very disciplined, I understand. If you decide to do something, you know, like give up smoking, that's what you do. You're very single-minded.
Yeah. Then I will wait for a frog person to come. No, what am I allowed to do on this desert island? Can I build anything?
Yes, I mean, as long as you make it from, you know, whatever presents itself there.
Yeah. Would there be any charcoal there?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Or okay. You could make some, you know, you can rub some sticks together.
Absolutely.
And do all those things.
All those kind of things.
And what about, you know, because you have a lot of time to kind of mull it all over, look back across it all in far greater depth than we've done here this morning, but... If you could rewrite a bit of it, your professional history, would you change anything?
You know, something I'd probably actually have to be there to figure out what I would change to instead of talking about it here. But I chose a book called The Distant Mirror that Barbara Tuchman wrote about the 14th century and combined with the Bible and the works of Shakespeare, which I'm allowed to take, yeah?
Sure.
I think I would have everything that I need because the 14th century echoes the 20th century. And Enguerrand de Cussy, who is the kind of character that she follows through the 14th century, everything that happens to them and everything that they ate, everything that they did and wore, all of that echoes backwards and forwards, back to the Bible, forwards to where we are. So I would be so full of thought about that. And I'm sure early in the evening I would do some introspection, but less so than I imagine one might imagine that I would do.
Tell me about your last record.
My wife told me to take this one. Deanne Dufresne is a dear friend. She's a blood sister of my dearly beloved wife. And my wife said to me, you have to take this record because this will tell you everything you need to know. And the record is called J'ai rencontré l'homme de ma vie. In other words, she's telling me that she found the man of her life, and even if I'm there, she's waiting for me somewhere. Aujourd'hui, j'ai rencontré l'homme de ma vie. Aujourd'hui, au grand soleil, en plein midi, on attend.
Deanne Dufresne singing J'ai rencontré l'homme de ma vie, and that's you. If you could only take one of those records, Donald, which one would you take?
Well, I'm going to take the Dennis Brain, the Mozart, because I know that my wife said to take that one, but my wife is walking through the Mozart horn concerto with wet hair and with a white towel around her rear end, and she's turning around and she's laughing and she's doing her toenails. No, I take the Mozart.
The horn concerto.
Yeah.
Your book, you've told us, is The Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman. What about your luxury?
I can have a luxury. Eh? Mm-hmm. I can have whatever I want.
It can't be of practical value. I mean, it has to be, you know, luxurious.
Oh, this is luxurious. I want 100 cases of red Bordeaux. I want 1982, 1986. I want things like Mouton Rothschild. I want Lafitte.
Oh. And you want a corkscrew?
I want a corkscrew, yes. And I guess probably because they're wooden cases, I would need something to open the wooden cases. But if I'm there long enough, I can grow my fingernails long enough. But I won't build anything with the boxes.
Good-o. You got the rules right. Donald Sutherland, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Can I tell you something? I never dreamt I would be able to do this program. I used to listen to this program 40 years ago. I loved this program. I'm so happy to have been here.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.